I've ridden my bicycle home many times, but on this particular fall afternoon in sunny California, I arrived home and walked in the back door, met by my wife, and I knew that was a unique day. She had our little baby Joel in her arms, and she did a quick once-over, making sure that I was okay. And then informed me there has just been a massive earthquake in the Bay Area. October 17th, 1989. We didn't feel it because we live in Rockland. And it's called that because Rockland is built on a rock right at the base of the Sierra Nevada mountains. Though the earthquake was felt all the way to Reno, we didn't feel it. I didn't know that anything was amiss that particular day. Neither did a man by the last name of Jones in the Bay Area. That particular day was the day that he received in his possession his dream car. A nice, fast, red Porsche. And as he picked up that car at the dealership, he drove straight to Candlestick Park to enjoy the third game of the World Series. Parked his car in the parking lot, went into the stadium, only to find out, as everybody else did, that that game never was completed on that particular day. So he went back to the parking lot, only to find out that there was something amiss. His car. He reported it to the authorities, but the police were a little preoccupied with other things. Cleaning up the devastation related to the earthquake, for one. Well, subsequently to that, they did find his Porsche. It was underneath the Nimitz Freeway that had collapsed in the earthquake. Inside, the thief. He died in the car he stole. Sin, we can never run away from. Oh, we might get more than 10 miles away from our sin. We might get 20 years away from our sin. But there is one who has heard all, who has seen all, who understands the very thoughts and intentions of our hearts. He knows us well, and we can never escape our sin. There's another man who enjoyed red Porsches. This particular man was a very strong and powerful man. His physical strength was only shadowed by his strength of personality. He was a well-decorated soldier. He grew up in the ranks militarily and then politically, and in his mid-30s he found himself on the top of the heap of a world empire. This man loved cars. And that particular car that he crashed in had a particular name. A little different car than maybe you might expect. But it was fast, and it was red, and it was a pedal to the metal kind of car. Her name was Bathsheba. You're familiar with the story of David and Bathsheba. We find it in 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12. That is the background for the psalm we'll begin looking at this morning, Psalm 51. As we continue our study through the book of Psalms in a rather eclectic manner, I want you to look at the superscription of Psalm 51. It says, for the choir director. In other words, this psalm that many people have used down through the ages as a personal penitential psalm was written by David to be public. You remember that after David committed his sin with Bathsheba, he had her husband Uriah killed. Of course, Bathsheba was pregnant. That's how David found out about this mess, and he tried to cover up his tracks. The baby was born. The baby subsequently died. And it was after all of that that the prophet Nathan came to David and said, "You are the man." Immediately, David was broken. He confessed his sin to God. This is his public confession of his sin. The superscription finishes, "For the choir director, a psalm of David when Nathan the prophet came to him after he had gone in to Bathsheba." I'm going to read Psalm 51. It's in its entirety, but this morning we're only going to get through the first 9 verses. Let me begin at verse 1. "Be gracious to me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the greatness of your compassion. Blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions and my sin is ever before me. Against you, you only, I have sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are justified when you speak and blameless when you judge. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. Behold, you desire truth in the innermost being, and in the hidden part you will make known wisdom. Purify me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me to hear joy and gladness. Let the bones which you have broken rejoice. Hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit within me. Do not cast me away from your presence, and do not take your Holy Spirit from me. Restore to me the joy of your salvation, and sustain me with a willing spirit. Then I will teach transgressors your ways, and sinners will be converted to you. Deliver me from blood guiltiness, O God, the God of my salvation. Then my tongue will joyfully sing of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips, that my mouth may declare your praise. For you do not delight in sacrifice, otherwise I would give it. You are not pleased with burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God. You will not despise. By your favor, do good to Zion. Build the walls of Jerusalem. Then you will delight in the righteous sacrifices, in burnt offering and whole burnt offering. Then young bulls will be offered on your altar." The psalm can be broken down into 2 sections. First is a prayer for pardon, and the second, a prayer for purity. They're very well balanced. That's how God works. First, He works a work of pardon and forgiveness in our heart. And then He works a work of purity unto holiness. The first verses that we'll look at this morning, we're going to divide into 2 sections. First, the cry because of sin, verses 1 and 2. Second, the confession of sin in verses 3 to 6. And then the plea because of sin in verses 7 and 9. As you look at the first verse, I want you to notice, depending on your translation, the first word is one of mercy or one of grace. Before David talks about his sin, he talks about God's character, specifically that character quality of mercy. That is most important. That is predominant on David's mind. Why? Well, in part, he knew because of his sin, he dare not come before the throne of God looking for justice. Nor do he dare come before the throne of God as though he needed to communicate some new knowledge to God. God, you obviously are not aware of something. Nor did he dare approach the throne of God trying to prove his innocence. Because he knew God is an omniscient God. God is an omnipresent God. God knew it all. God heard it all. So he speaks first of God's mercy. That's the cry of a sinner. Speaking, pleading for, looking, longing for God's mercy. We didn't invent that. God did. You remember in the book of Exodus, after Moses received the Ten Commandments, he came down the mountain. There they were worshiping the golden calf. He threw down those two tablets. And subsequent to that, in his hunger, Moses cried out to God, "I want to know you more. I want to see your glory." Now, I don't know what would possess a man to be so bold to say such things, yet they came out of Moses' mouth. And so God says, "Okay, Moses, I'm going to hide you in the cleft of the rock. And I'm going to pass by you, Moses, and I'm going to declare my name to you as I pass by." That special covenantal name, Yahweh. And it was at that time that God said to Moses, "I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy. And I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion." And it was there that God revealed to Moses, "I am a merciful God." So David came with boldness, speaking first of God's mercy, because God had previously revealed himself that way. David says, "Be merciful to me, O God, according to your loving kindness." In other words, he says, "God, would you be merciful as you are merciful? God, just be yourself. According to your loving kindness." That's that Hebrew word chesed, referring to God's covenantal, loyal love. He says, "God, would you be merciful just as you have continuously and abundantly and always shown mercy to your people?" That's his plea. And my friends, we don't need more religious stuff. We don't need more religion. We don't need more good stuff, good deeds to do. What we need as sinners before a holy God is mercy. David continues in the middle of verse 1 into verse 2. He says, "According to the greatness of your compassion, blot out my transgressions, wash me thoroughly from my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin." David knew very, very well what was standing between him and holy God. And he uses three words to describe it: transgressions, iniquity, and sin. The word transgressions means to cross the line. Let me give you an old illustration and an up-to-date illustration. Julius Caesar was commanded by the Roman Senate to not cross the river Rubicon. To do so was to invoke the wrath of the Senate. And so what did Julius Caesar do? He crossed the river. He crossed over the line. He transgressed the law of the Senate. With these words, "The die is cast." It brought civil war in Rome. Modern day illustration, You as parents, you as grandparents, or you as children, know very well when parents lay down the line. You are not to cross this line. This is how we behave. We don't behave like this. When you cross the line, there are consequences. To cross the line is to transgress the law. David knew he had stepped across God's line. The second word he uses is the word iniquity. You'll find that word also in verse 5. It speaks of original sin. It speaks of our depravity. Every person on the face of the earth is a depraved person. That means every person who has ever been birthed from Adam and Eve onward is born in sin. That means that there is nothing about us that is pure and winsome and wholesome in the eyes of God. Rabbi Harold Kushner years ago wrote a book titled When Bad Things Happen to Good People. On the basis of the title of that book, R.C. Sproul was once asked, why do bad things happen to good people? To which he responded, well, since I've never met a good person, I don't know. Everyone is born in sin. Now, I find this authenticated, if you will, by the Minnesota Crime Commission that reported this. Every baby starts life as a little savage. He is completely selfish and self-centered. He wants what he wants when he wants it. His bottle, his mother's attention, his playmate's toy, his uncle's watch. Deny him these wants and he sees with rage and aggressiveness, which would be murderous were he not helpless. He is dirty. He has no morals, no knowledge, no skills. This means that all children, not just certain children, are born delinquent. If permitted to continue in the self-centered world of his infancy, given free rein to his impulsive actions to satisfy his wants, every child would grow up a criminal, a thief, a killer, a rapist. I put this in your notes. Mark Twain said, we are all like the moon. We have a dark side we don't want anybody to see. That is iniquity. David says, I know my transgressions. I know my iniquity. I know my sin. That particular word comes from archery. We've talked about it many, many times before. It means to miss the mark, to fall short of God's perfect standard. Now these words, transgressions, iniquity, sin, reoccur in verse 1, in verse 2, in verse 3, in verse 4, in verse 5, in verse 9, in verse 13. This psalm is saturated with these words. I want you to notice the personal pronoun that David attaches to those words. Back in verse 1, my transgressions. Verse 2, my iniquity. My sin. This is the cry of a person who understands very well. There is something very serious between me and my God. Verses 3 to 6 speak of David's confession of sin. Verse 3, he says, for I know my transgressions and my sin is ever before me. This is a man who confesses his sin. I am wrong. I am at fault. There is nothing that he's trying to hide. He's not trying to justify himself. He's not trying to pull the wool over anybody's eyes. He comes clean. I want you to notice that in so doing, he does not put himself right in front of God's gun of wrath. No, this kind of confession does not lead to God's wrath. It is the necessary prerequisite whereby we are enabled to experience God's mercy. He has predetermined that confession and mercy be commingled. They are necessary for each other. Now, as a part of his confession, in verse 4, he says something interesting. He says, "Against you, you only, I have sinned and done what is evil in your sight." Now, how can he say that? For he has violated another woman. He has murdered her husband and tried to cover up the whole mess. How can David say, "I have only sinned against you, O God"? Well, here's a couple of ideas. It may be that David has in his mind that which is most grievous. Was it wrong for him to sin against Bathsheba and Uriah? Yes! With 3 exclamation points after it. But it may have been that David, thinking, realizing that God was the creator of these 2 human beings, and he destroyed their lives, it may be that he realized, "God, I've sinned against you because you are the one who created that life. And I've taken that life. I've destroyed this person's life." He may have been focusing on the more grievous of those deeds. It may have been that David was realizing that God's law is unchangeable. Now, as it is with all monarchs, and particularly the Oriental despots of David's day, if they didn't like a law, they changed it. And the laws could come and go from the books depending on the whim of the monarch. But David is confronted with that steel, iron, unchangeable law of God. And he's looking into that law, not the changing of the man's laws that can come and go. He could easily have explained that away. Easily have justified himself, especially in light of his peers, those other kings around. They all did the same thing. But David was not going to quibble and squabble over the word "is." He came clean. He looked into the light of God's unchanging, iron, steel-clad law, and he said, "I am guilty. Against you, you only, have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you are justified when you speak and blameless when you judge." As God, as David came before God, he realized in his holiness, in his righteousness, in his blamelessness, he had nowhere to stand except on God's mercy. And he realized that even apart from God's mercy, he would be just to throw the book at him, to take his life. In verse 5, David says this, "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me." He may have had these thoughts in his mind, in verse 5, as he said those words that are maybe a little difficult for us to understand in the beginning of verse 4. For you see, in David's understanding, this incident with Bathsheba and Uriah was simply one rock in a whole mountain of rock that David had to deal with. He came before the Lord because of what happened with Bathsheba and Uriah. But what that did is it brought a spotlight on his, shone a spotlight on his soul. And he saw the depth of the problem he had to deal with. He says, I was brought forth in iniquity, in sin my mother conceived me. I have always had this problem of something standing between me and you, O God. It's this verse. This is one of the verses that we look at and then subsequently come to the conclusion that the Bible teaches this doctrine of original sin or the doctrine of total depravity. Charles Spurgeon says, I'll put this in your note, as the salt flavors every drop in the Atlantic, so does sin affect every atom of our nature. It is so sadly there, so abundantly there, that if you cannot detect it, you are deceived. Now, the doctrine of total depravity does not mean that we are utterly depraved. It doesn't mean that we are as bad as we could be. But it means that in our body, in our mind, in our soul, every aspect of our life has been stained with sin. Behold, you desire truth in the innermost being, David writes in verse 6. And in the hidden part, you will make me know wisdom. I want you to notice that verse 5 and the beginning of verse 6, they both begin with the word behold. But with those two words, there is an enormous gulf between who I am and who God is. And David rightly recognizes that unless God takes the initiative, unless God moves in such a way, I will never understand wisdom, and I will never escape from the weight of my guilt. Beginning of verse 7, he gets very specific with God. This is what he longs for. This is what he prays for. This is the crux of his prayer for pardon. Verse 7, he says, purify me with hyssop and I will shall be clean. Wash me and I will be whiter than snow. Verse 9, hide your face from my sins and blot out all my iniquities. He uses these three phrases. It's a repeat of what he's already said in verses 1 and 2. He uses these three phrases to describe, God, this is what I need you to do. I need you to purify, I need you to wash, and I need you to blot out. The word purify and the word sin in the Hebrew are related together. So when David prays, God purify me, or cleanse me, as your translation might read, he literally says, God, I want you to de-sin me. When he says, wash me, I picture somebody who's doing laundry by hand and scrubbing those fabrics. David realizes that the fabric of his soul has been laying in dye for months and months. Every fiber of his soul has sucked up this dye. It's impenetrable. And even though he would squeeze his life to get rid of that dye, it has permanently altered that garment. And so he says to God, God, wash me, bleach me, scrub me, clean me up. And then he says, blot out all my iniquities. That word blot out means to cleanse by scraping away. There is this by way of an illustration here. There are certain biblical manuscripts that are written on a certain kind of papyrus that are called palimpsests. P-A-L-I-M-P-S-E-S-T-S. Palimpsests. What they are is a papyrus that has been written on previously. And because of the expensive nature of securing writing material like that, you sometimes reuse some of those papyrus. Scrape them of the ink that was used previously, and then they turn it on its side and reuse it. Some of our biblical manuscripts are written in that kind of manner. David, using that same kind of imagery, says, God, scrape me clean. Bleach me. Do whatever it is to expunge my indictment that is written in your book. David knew that this came at a high price. And that's why he said, verse 7, purify me with hyssop. Hyssop is a plant related to the mint. It's part of the mint family. By its structure, that is, its stem and its leaves, it was used for a variety of different reasons, one of which was for painting. It was the hyssop plant that God instructed the Israelites to use after they killed the Passover lamb prior to leaving Egypt. He was there to take a hyssop plant and dip it into the blood of that lamb and sprinkle it over the doorposts of their homes. Hyssop appears a couple of other times in the Mosaic Law. David uses that imagery of the hyssop plant being used, taking from the blood of the innocent victim and spread over the sinner's life. David uses that imagery to say, God, I know that it's going to be the blood of an innocent victim that's going to somehow cover me. Now, he didn't have the perspective that we have on this side of the cross to understand who that perfect Passover lamb is. Jesus is that one into whom David said, I'll take my hyssop plant and dip it into my Creator, the Lord Jesus, and apply that blood to my life. Forgiveness, God's pardon, comes at a very high price. Back in the Civil War, there was a young woman of 22 years that died in a hospital. She was the envy of many of her peers due to her beauty and her charm. She was well educated. She was socially very astute. And yet she made poor choices such that she became a prostitute and died at the age of 22. Among her personal effects were found this poem, a poem that she wrote titled Beautiful Snow, that captured her life and her experience. Oh, the snow, the beautiful snow, filling the sky and the earth below, over the housetops, over the street, over the heads of the people you meet, dancing, skimming, flirting along. Beautiful snow, it can do no wrong. Beautiful snow from the heavens above, pure as an angel and gentle as love. Once I was pure as the snow, but I fell. Fell like the snow flakes from heaven to hell. Fell to be trampled as filth in the street. Fell to be scoffed, to be spat on and beat. Pleading and cursing and dreading to die. Selling my soul to whoever would buy. Dealing in shame for a morsel of bread. Hating the living and fearing the dead. Merciful God, have I fallen so low? And yet I was once like the beautiful snow. Once I was fair as the beautiful snow, with an eye like its crystal and heart like its glow. Once I was loved for my innocent grace, flattered and sought for the charms of my face. Father, mother, sister, and all, God and myself, I have lost by my fall. Fainting, freezing, dying alone, too weak for prayer, too weak for a moan, to be heard in the streets of the crazy town, gone mad in the joy of the snow coming down, to lie and to die in my terrible woe, with a bed and a shroud of beautiful snow. Years later, another author penned these lines as a fitting conclusion to her unfinished poem. Helpless and frail as the trampled snow, sinner, despair not, Christ stoopeth low to rescue the soul that is lost in its sin and raise it to life and enjoyment again. Groaning, bleeding, dying for thee, the crucified hung, made a curse on the tree. As accents of mercy fall soft on thine ear, is there mercy for me? Will he hear my prayer? O God, in the stream that for sinners doth flow, wash me, and I will be whiter than snow. It hearkens to Isaiah's words, come, let us reason together. And though your sins be as scarlet, they will be as white as snow. Every sinner who is found in a right relationship with their Creator must come by way of confession and must come by way of the cross. It is God's foreordained means by which we experience and embrace His mercy.